Hello and welcome back to Building Our Future with me, Bert Broadhead. Today we're joined by a rising star of UK architecture to explore themes of wellness and urban design, innovation and affordable housing, and the process of seeing master plans become reality. My guest today is Andrew McMullen, director of McMullen Studios, a new architectural practice embracing the winds of change across several of the themes that we've explored thus far on the podcast. Andrew, welcome to Building Our Future.
Thanks, Bert. Nice to be here.
So McMullen Studio have recently won a competition to develop a vision for a new knowledge quarter in Innsbruck, Austria. Understand that this is very much focused on wellness. Could you just talk us through the background to your involvement in this project?
I set up McMullen Studio with a very simple mission to create projects of every scale, where wellbeing, culture, diversity and sustainability were designed into daily life. Europan and this competition for Innsbruck, it was an open competition, an international one. And it was an opportunity to bring our experience working on large master plans at big studios in London onto a project for ourselves. And we love regenerating new parts of cities. We've got experience of doing that on the Olympic Park, and we put our best foot forward and developed up a concept around healthy cities, and we won.
And how many people were you up against in this competition?
There were several hundred, actually, which always makes you think whether you should have entered that competition given the odds.
Okay, so you've got this winning vision, and what are the next steps in the process?
It's the early stages of developing up a strategic approach or roadmap for the design development. So we're moving through a series of workshops with the city of Innsbruck, the mayor of Innsbruck, and various departments within the city. And it's a complex project. It's a site that is strategically around 17 hectares, and its built form accounts for around 10, 12 hectares. It sits on the River Inn, and it's right next to the brook. So essentially, it is the kind of spiritual home of the city. And yet, it's been such an overlooked and underused section of the river that it's clearly had some constraints and challenges in terms of its past and its future development.
When we think about wellness, there's spiritual wellness, there's physical wellness, there's emotional wellness. How do you go about incorporating these kind of themes into building or civic design?
The interest with this project was applying some of those principles to a piece of city, and they are fundamentally good principles. And the theme of the competition was productivity, and to be productive, you have to be happy and healthy. So I think lots of those themes under that umbrella can be delivered in city planning, in the architecture. And in order for us to do that, we took a very sort of broad strategy where we invited academic institutions, the botanical gardens, restaurateurs, local businesses, large and small, to begin discussions about how we might work together to develop ideas around that theme. So essentially the district is charged with the study and the research and the science and the data around well-being and wellness in the city, with a view to that being applicable to other cities in Europe and the rest of the world.
So the stakeholders you're engaging with, does their responsibility kind of stop at just giving you feedback, or are they kind of integral partners in helping deliver these themes of wellness?
They are well integrated. I mean, they are, on the one hand, there are some that have a natural interest in it and the city and are less hands-on, and others are actually engaging with the idea of occupying space within the master plan. So we've got a building on the waterfront that would have a humanities and architectural component, a sort of incubator businesses, and is putting, I suppose, outposts of various institutions and places in the city into a singular building and charging them with this study. So they are kind of getting on board with the idea of collaborating, and we're helping to create spaces for that to happen.
If happy and healthy people equals productive people, then really, I suppose, one of the key tenets of wellness is this concept of interconnectivity. So the more you can bring different people together, arguably the kind of better sense of wellness you develop.
What we like about cities, I think, is it's the level of diversity and inclusivity to them. And I think we thrive on that, with meeting new people and exchanging ideas with different cultures and so on. And I think that's a key part of developing a productive place, because otherwise you end up with very narrow fields of vision. And I don't think that represents what cities are good at. I think, you know, global cities and important cities are ones that have the widest influence. And I think that comes from an understanding of people and the sorts of places that they would like to work, relax, and live in. And I think as an architect and urban designer, that's our role, is to provide that framework for people to express themselves in the best way possible.
I think where I'm going is that your sense of definition of wellness is much more integrated into the kind of fabric of how buildings work than, you know, pictures of lots of trees and outdoor gyms and just kind of paying lip service to the idea.
I think it's about people, actually. I think it's about, you know, high levels of empathy in us as designers and really getting under the skin of a population and trying to find the particularities of the people and what they might require that's different to anywhere else. And I think from that you can create very specific and very well catered environments for those people. And I think it, you know, it's inside and outside of the building. We're working on a project for Chelsea Flower Show. So we're doing the M&G show garden for next year. And that's been designed as a pocket park. And the type of planting that's in there is appropriate for today, but also appropriate for a climate in 2050, where London will reach a sort of Barcelona climb. So what's important about that kind of space is that the smallest spaces can have the biggest impact. You know, the community garden where you live, that space that you can grab lunch near work, it doesn't need to be very large. It doesn't need to be Hyde Park. And frankly, I can't remember the last time I took a walk in Hyde Park. But there are green spaces that I really enjoy on my daily commute or where I live. And I think that ultimately cities and master plans are a collection of many, many elements. And so the ability to zoom out and zoom in to look at the human scale, and to zoom out to be quite strategic about the sort of stakeholders you pull in to help to deliver it and to shape it, I think is what makes cities very interesting, and what makes my role within developing these places very exciting.
How do you balance the art of collaboration versus moving things forward and not having to seek consensus on every micro decision?
I think it's the formulation of a vision is very important. I think nobody really likes change. Although our cities are excellent at changing and adapting. And so to galvanize thinking and support around a direction, there needs to be a kind of a vision and something that paints a very kind of attractive picture of where we're going. And I think underneath that is a set of objectives, and then that sets a framework for conversations with everyone. So it's a sort of a bit of top and a bit of bottom up. And but I think more than ever, I think we need to listen to community groups and really, you know, walk into the local chip shop and start talking to people and to kind of get under the skin of the people that ultimately, you know, are electing the people that are making the decisions. So in a way that they all do actually tend to sort of tie together.
Are you a fan of embracing technology to aid with stakeholder engagement, or are you still a fan of boots on the ground?
You can't beat boots on the ground, because as most people will appreciate, you know, Zoom calls are challenging, aren't they? And in that you pick up a lot from the nuances of body language and things like that. And I think people really appreciate the effort to speak to people, you know, whether it's at the school gates or the pub. And we've run workshops in all sorts of locations in order that we get the best sort of input and we have the best kind of exercises in listening. So technology is definitely plays a part, and you know, VR is very helpful in terms of like painting a picture on site for people to see a development. There are various sort of you know, whiteboard digital device, you know, Miro and things like that, where people can start to drop their post-it notes and thinking around it. But I think, you know, technology's got a really, really important role. And but I think, you know, technology doesn't suit everyone. And I think if we are trying to create an inclusive and diverse city, there are those that don't have the same sort of access to technology, whether that's through level of skill or just through, you know, access.
What are the timeframes in Innsbruck, and what can we look forward to seeing next?
Next year, we'll be starting to release a little bit more information on it. It's a slow process there. It's not been helped with, you know, recent developments, but I think, you know, middle of next year, we'll start to see some things on paper and some actual sort of shaping of decisions.
Fantastic opportunity to A, be working on a high profile site, but B, where you've got a partner, the city, who seem kind of really committed to helping you deliver this.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're working on a master plan as well with my old practice, Allies and Morrison. That's a 15 hectare site in Skipton in Yorkshire. And they are, you know, relieved that they haven't actually started to deliver any master plan work before COVID, because it's totally thrown everything up in the air for them. And so we've gone about, you know, developing a similar set of themes around Skipton, but very much playing up the hero of this town, which is the canal, which is an interesting part of the town where, you know, up until recently that has been a backside really for the town. But they have enormous levels of ambition, and it's fantastic to see how they are pursuing a net zero town in 2030. There are ambitious people out there, which is you know, one of the most important things about setting up the studio was, and I get this asked a lot, is, you know, what sort of projects do you want to work on? And frankly, our experience is extremely broad, and we are curious about all sorts of projects, from cities to rural workspaces in Kent. But we want to work with fantastic and ambitious clients who share our passion for making a difference.
Moving from the macro to the micro, or perhaps the more conceptual, you've also been involved with plans for affordable rural homes for young people. What are your guiding key principles for the future of rural homes?
Rural homes is, I think, especially affordable homes, has a more acute problem than actually affordable homes in cities. The project that we're working on is called the Flexstead, and it's targeting actually young people in rural areas. Reason being that these remote villages are hollowing out of people. The post office is closing, the local schools are closing, and they need to re-energize those with young people. And I think and this was the sort of pre kind of COVID idea, but we incorporated workspace within those homes, the ability to kind of work from home and consequently sort of help to support a local high street or a local economy. But yeah, the affordability of it is difficult. But we're using modern methods of construction. So we're using sit panel systems. We're using cement-free concrete foundations, which are very, very sustainable. We're using no concrete slab. It's a timber slab. So the consequences of all of that is we're losing about 8 weeks off the program. So it's both a higher quality product because it's made in the factory, and the speed of delivery is so much better. So this it will be a prototype. There's 10 of these homes, 2 beds and 3 beds, and that will be a prototype that could be rolled around the Yorkshire Dales.
And these are timber framed?
Yes, they're timber framed, yeah.
CLT or just... or
We looked at CLT, but it's not a viable... on that scale, it's not viable. And so we switched...
Overly specified.
Yeah, we switched to a structurally insulated panel. So those are timber frame modular units, which have the insulation in, and to an extent, we're integrating all the conduits within that as well. So that is extremely fast, less timber, and actually more sustainable in this particular instance.
And you touched on the COVID factor, which I suppose is challenging for all sorts of reasons, but not least because it's probably changing what people are looking for in their homes. And you know, the working from home bit is a key element to that. Do you think there are other preferential choices that are going to be impacted by COVID?
It's certainly flexibility. It was about providing the minimal number of rooms needed to, you know, enclose a bathroom, enclose your bedrooms, and the ground floor is quite open. And what that enabled us to do is to incorporate a whole different series of configurations depending on the mode in a day. So whether it's kind of foldable partitions or it was a mode in the next 5-10 years. So the idea being that your place could evolve over time depending on your circumstances, depending on the growth of your family, or whether you're renting and sharing space, whether you're working from home more or less. I think one thing that's taught us is there are no knowns. And I think the strength of projects is that ability to kind of be flexible and adaptable and do that in a very cost-effective way. And there is nothing, as a person who comes in to buy a house, there's nothing worse than buying a house with all the walls in the wrong place and then spending money demolishing them. You'd much rather save your money, spend it on your passions if you're buying an affordable home when you're a first-time homeowner, and then building those walls when you need them.
That's exactly right. And when you think about, you know, your remit of designing affordable rural homes for young people don't stay young, unfortunately, but people do stay in homes for an awful long time. So flexibility must be key, but also I suppose it's cost is probably the most important thing to attracting young people.
And it's not just the capital cost. I mean, our homes there are around £1,200 a square meter, and it's quite passive house design, which I think is, you know, an incredible achievement, and a lot of thanks goes to our kind of partners on that, which are Atelier 10 environmental engineers and Elliott Wood structural engineers, both at the forefront of it within their disciplines on sustainable design. So there's a drive to get that capital cost down, but at the same time we need the running cost to be low, you know, the affordability of heating and so on. And but so by creating a highly insulated building shell, to invest in that, in the robustness of the detailing, the low maintenance, is a good starting point. So we've calculated that, and we will run these tests post-occupancy, but we're estimating that the electricity bill for a year will be around £250.
This seems to be one of the most kind of underplayed parts of MMC, that I think I'm yet to see it be kind of validated. But if the theory goes that by having that kind of additional rate of accuracy in the construction, the insulation is just that much better, that you really can bring down the running costs really dramatically.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do we need to think about other ways of kind of keeping young people in communities beyond housing design?
We got to be careful, with, I guess, with generalizations about young people or any age, actually. I think we're a much more complex society than we sort of appreciate. And, you know, if you think about later living, which is a passion of ours, and we're exploring some ideas around that, we'd love the opportunity to sort of test those ideas on real projects. But thinking about my own parents, and when they, you know, not too distant future, they will be going to retirement homes, what kind of experience would I like them to have? And frankly, that looking at what's available, it's pretty poor. So the expectation is it's a suburban gated community somewhere, but my parents love trying new food, exploring, you know, going to the theater, meeting friends, and so that complexity to our society needs to be considered. But I think, you know, picking up on the young person thing, I think it's about adaptability and flexibility, so that our stock of homes and houses can evolve and tune into the personality of the young people that want to occupy that. And that's an interesting thing to kind of explore as a designer.
There's kind of interesting other themes in there, which is a whole plethora of reasons for why this happens. But people do tend to think of, you know, retirement homes, and it's still the assumption that people of a similar age want to or ought to live together. Whereas a proven now way of keeping older people young is mixing them with younger generations.
That comes back to that point about, you know, looking at the whole different scales of the master plan. You know, on a human scale, you know, you can put a kindergarten next to a retirement home or later living home, and there's clearly and proven benefits to both residents there. You know, there's a fantastic kind of like transfer of happiness and skill and knowledge that goes on there, and you've got people in their later lives, continuing to contribute as citizens by, you know, participating in community work with young children, and at a city scale, those same principles apply. How do we provide the places for the convergence of different types of people? And I think that's can only be a good thing.
So right now, Andrew, you're master planning in Innsbruck, you're regenerating in Yorkshire, designing rural homes. What else is in the pipeline?
So we're working on a really exciting project, which is just going in for planning next month, which is for a high quality rural workspace in Kent. So that's around 30,000 square foot, and it's a repurposed farm very close to a small station which gives you quick access into London, and our amazing client had this idea pre-COVID, and they're accelerating their thinking and expansion now. But the idea of how do you provide great workspace near to where you live, because for the vast majority of us, we aren't all lucky enough to have the right sort of space in our own homes. And so being able to cycle or walk to a place would be really helpful. So in this instance, it's in an area of outstanding natural beauty. It's an incredible landscape where the client is actually rewilding a huge area of land. And then we are repurposing existing buildings and completely reinvigorating this farm into another a form of productivity. So it's it's no longer about cows and pigs, and it's about people. It's extremely tight budget on this project. So one of the first things we've done is an audit of all of the existing materials on the farm. So we're adopting circular economy principles and trying to find ways in which we can ensure that every single material on the farm is reused, recycled, repurposed in some way. So we're looking at reuse of blockwork walls as internal partitions. We're looking at ways in which concrete rubble and bricks can be ground down, mixed together to form a mortar to create rendered walls.
Have you ever looked at cob?
Cob, exactly. That sort of, yeah. We're inspired by craft. We really enjoy prototyping and experimenting with materials. And we love the idea of making a place from the landscape and the materials that are found. And that has enormous cost benefits, as well as being an incredibly sustainable approach. We did an exercise in just calculating the embodied carbon in the concrete slabs on the farm, and it equated to around 120 homes running for a year. So our first move was to think about how we could place any new construction onto those slabs in order that we avoid excavation and we can use it as the foundations.
Yeah, I love the sound of that. I'd love to see the output when it's ready. So this brings us on to our final couple of questions, which is, firstly, can you recommend us a book that's influenced your professional thinking?
There's a book called Creativity Inc., and it's by one of the founders of Pixar, a guy called Ed Catmull. And it's a really inspiring book about how to create a creative culture within it. And so I've referenced it and thought about it a lot in terms of how I've developed up the core values of my own studio. But it also deals with some of the fears of a designer. He talks about how his artistic directors, when considering some of these amazing films, you know, how they deal with the white piece of paper, you know, that blank piece of paper at the beginning, and they talk about it's like a dark tunnel that there is a tiny light at the end of it, but you know that if you carry on going, feeling your way along this tunnel, there is only one exit, and you trust in your process. So as a designer, I really enjoy not knowing the answer, and I'm very comfortable with that level of uncertainty. But I've honed a process of design, or rather our studio has honed a process of design to uncover what the solution is. And it's having the confidence to, you know, use that process to uncover what that idea is and the solutions. And I think that's had a major impact on my thinking.
Sold. It's going on my Christmas list. And which technology do you think has the greatest potential to change the status quo in your line of work?
I think there's so many. I mean, you know, wearable devices are very interesting. I think that there's an opportunity for the, you know, in the right way, the collection of data around how we use our buildings and use our cities, and using that data then to inform decisions in the future. And I think that sort of thing is happening a lot in mobility and vehicles. And, you know, I, when you think about cars, you know, there's 2/3 of open space in cities are being used for cars, and 80% of life of their lives are actually parked. So I think technology that enables more cars or vehicles to be moving and not parked can only help to reveal and uncover and free up potential for, you know, other development, you know, whether that's new space for an urban farm or a new building. I think that's has great potential for improving our cities.
Completely agree. I think I'd love to understand more about the failure of Sidewalk Labs over in Toronto and how much of that was about their proposed use of data and the backlash against it. So kind of to your point, it needs to be managed carefully. Our final question is, do you have a favorite building or city or anything like that?
I would say the Royal Festival Hall, actually. I think it embodies a spirit of an age, a period of inventiveness and creativity. You know, the Festival of Britain, the value in new ideas and fresh perspectives, I think was embodied in that building. And I think today it belongs to Londoners, and it's a very accessible building to explore, to use. You know, you don't need to spend any money to go and enjoy that space. And I think we need more of those buildings, because I think it makes other commercial uses around it very viable. But we do need those sorts of places for people to want to continue to live in our cities.
So to end on a happy note, are you confident or optimistic that from COVID we're going to see another kind of burst of creativity and enthusiasm in response to this?
Absolutely. I think these have.
I'm glad you said that.
You know, it's accelerated all of this thinking fast, and I for one I'm keen to get going on things. You know, I'm really passionate about turning projects into reality. So it's fantastic that the upshot of things is it's accelerating thinking, it's moving forward, demands on tackling climate change and improving our health and well-being. And I think extremely optimistic, and there's huge opportunities out there for everyone.
And Andrew, if people are listening and they want to get in touch, what's the best way?
You can email me on andrew@macmullanstudio.com.
And can we, is there a way of kind of keeping up to date with projects, etc.?
Yeah, there's an Instagram account @macmullanstudio and our website www.macmullanstudio.com.
Be sure to follow it. Andrew, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Not only living in a world of rapid technological change, but also one where people's priorities are rapidly shifting. The coronavirus means that certain trends like wellness are likely to be accelerated, while others, like housing design, will need to be re-examined. Technology means that developers and architects can collaborate more than ever with end users and stakeholders. Hopefully, this means that visions like Innsbruck's really do emerge intact when they're delivered in reality. But it also means that we may need to think more about where decision-making needs to be delegative or representative, and where it should be community-led. As ever, if you've enjoyed the episode, please do recommend the show to a friend or colleague. It's hugely appreciated. Until next time, thank you for listening.